What's going on, everybody? We are back with Red Leg Talk, and I'm with Chris Wright. How you doing, Chris?
I am awesome. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. I'm doing great, man. I'm sitting here having a whiskey sour and chit-chatting with you about hunting and stuff, so it's a pretty good night.
Well, that's good. I'm not drinking alone. I got a bourbon and Coke going out because it's been a long day, but it's been a fun one.
Yeah. We're at that time of year where the days are short, but it seems like you're not done till 10 o'clock at night.
Oh, yeah. No arguments there, man. So you got planning, you got, you know, figuring out plan B, plan C, plan D. So, and it's all good, especially when you're into birds.
Yeah. We're actually recording this right before you guys open up with some southern duck over there in Ohio.
Yeah, finally. Yeah, that was actually my biggest problem during goose season was we were short on geese and we were looking pretty good on duck. So we actually did a makeshift scouting / goose hunt expedition the other day, and honestly, if I had 10 guys in the blind with us, we would have run full tags. I mean, it was gadwalls, widgeon, mallards. So golden eyes, which was kind of a shocker. We saw a few cans, saw some ringbacks. So, and this was all in between us just putting a beating on the geese. So it was a fun day. But yeah, we actually got some really good information, especially for the opener. So there's a big group of guys going down there. So I actually just got off the phone with one of them telling them, hey, this is what you may want to do. And, you know, go on down there the day ahead of time, just kind of see what they're doing.
Yeah, man, that's pretty awesome. I know we just opened back up for geese, and it has done a 180 flip. I ended November on a pretty good hunt, killing six birds. We should have killed a whole lot more, but as the argument went that day, it was pretty obvious the direction we needed to look to be able to keep our eyes from, like, duck season was in, so we thought we needed to be able to keep our eyes on the river to catch stuff flying the river instead of kind of playing the wind a little bit. And I mean, it was under, the wind stayed under 2 miles an hour all day and no ducks, but the geese played and they wanted to play with a 2 mile per hour wind, less than a 2 mile per hour wind. And it was just rough. Just couldn't get them to finish right. But, you know, I mean, we shot out pretty good number of birds. We just didn't get a finish, one or two groups that would have finished us off is really all that kind of happened. Had a pretty good hunt though. I mean, I can't complain.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been worse. You could have got skunked. So, but even then, hanging out with friends is always a good time. But we just had one of those shoots. I think it was like 2 weeks ago, opening day of goose. It was a comedy of errors. So guy showed up late, which put everyone late. And I got to be honest, normally I'm leaving. If I say the bus leaves at 5:30, the bus leaves at 5:30. He called me and it was basically begging me not to leave. So I hung on and man, I wish I would have left. So, but yeah, the first two groups of geese that came into us, I was laying behind the blind flagging and calling because I wasn't done brushing my blind. So, and I wish the shooting had been straighter. Because by the time I got in my blind to get my gun loaded to actually start hunting, we had zero birds down. And as my one buddy put it, the problem is they're danger close. They're too close for us to hit. We expect them to be a little bit farther out. So yeah, a little ring rust on those guys. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it's really not about the numbers you kill. It's about the people you're hanging out with and having the good times and the laughs and stuff. I mean, we all want to shoot birds and we all want to kill birds, but probably so far one of my favorite hunts this year doesn't involve a goose at all. It actually involves a coyote, which was the hunt the other day where we swore we were watching coyotes run around in a field and kind of no birds flying. It's 9:30, 10 o'clock, no birds have flown yet. So I kind of look at the guy I was hunting with. I was like, you just want to walk up here and see if those coyotes are still hanging out like on the river. And we kind of take off walking, and I just told my dog to kind of stay in her blind and just left her there. And you know, what I thought was 400 yards away was actually like 800 yards away. And, turned out to be, some coyotes. Just one coyote bayed on the river by like four dogs. And it was pretty interesting to see it, 'cause I'd never seen that before. And, we actually kind of watched and then when we got there and the coyote knew we were there, it kind of turned into a fight. It actually got interesting as far as if you've ever bear hunted or I'd say coon hunted or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it got aggressive quick. He, his attitude about us being there was a lot more aggressive than the attitude about four dogs having him pinned in a river. But he kind of decided that he was going to swim the river a little bit, and he made it about 50 yards out, and I don't know what happened. It was a bunch of farm dogs from the farms around there, and they kind of, when they seen us there, they bailed out, and we kind of stood there and watched, and I thought, well, maybe he'll swim the river, and that'll be that. And, well, he decided that he couldn't swim the river, and he just tried out on our side, and resulted in a 3.5 to the head. And if you've ever seen a shotgunned coyote, it is one of the coolest things ever. I mean,
oh yeah, I know.
I mean, that, like, I shot him in the legs because I tried to lead him because I thought he was going to be running a little harder, being that we were 15 yards from him. So I led him way too far, but that other boy just smacked him in the face, and I was like, oh my gosh, that is the greatest thing ever. Like, I want to shoot every coyote I ever get to shoot with a shotgun now. It's like shooting a turkey. I mean, it's just a flop. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my favorite, I got a creek not too far from the house that it's one of those magic spots all guys wish they could find. It's got a cold water spring running into it, and man, every year it's one of these places. Like, I think last year we ended up putting 10 hunts in on it, and we finished over 180 birds. So, and we had some guys that had won a hunt we donated to Ducks Unlimited. So, and it turns out the guy that bought the hunt in the auction is a certified coyote junkie. Now, I know the farmer really well, and he hates coyotes. So, yeah, we had set up. We're sitting there. It's quiet time. It's about 10 minutes of shooting time. And all of a sudden, a coyote appears across the creek. So I just kind of whispered to him. I was like, yo. And he just, you know, kind of whispers back, where? I was like, directly across from us. You see him? So, and he's like, yep. Can I shoot him? I'm like, sure. And before I can even get the R out in sure, he pulls the trigger and lights this thing up. And it was a big old dog, big old coyote, so big male. So, and he dispatched him right away, and I am not kidding, not 5 minutes later, we have, you know, 30, 40 mallards just dumping into the kill hole. So we kind of waited out, and so long story short, we ended up just a wonderful hunt. These guys were just super happy. One of the birds I had to go fetch just so happened to be banded, so the guy went home with a full tag of ducks, a band, and a big old bull coyote. So it was a good time. It really was. But just watching that thing thump was just it reminds me of turkey hunting. That's a perfect analogy.
Yeah, and I mean, it's crazy because they've kind of moved a main highway where we hunt out a lot over here in West Virginia, and the amount of like coyotes that we have seen within a year of that road opening and moving everybody, like moving the main semis up off onto a main highway, is insane.
Yeah.
We've seen two coyotes on a November duck hunt. And I mean, they were just working the creek bank like that, you know, just sliding down through there. And I mean, the ducks didn't pay as much attention to them as I thought they would. I guess because they're kind of out on the water, they don't really worry as much about them. But they do kind of move the ducks, you know, out to deeper water. They don't kind of stay in the shallow water. I did notice that. And they did push about 10, 15 wood ducks all the way up a creek and out into the river. I mean, it was pretty impressive to watch them kind of work themselves around and do that.
You know, that's one of the things I learned when I was in North Carolina, coastal North Carolina. God, this was many, we're talking 20 years ago. I went down there for a swan hunt with two buddies. And old Bob Richin, so he says, like, you got to try it. And I'm not kidding. The guide we were with was, he actually teaches his dog how to do this. But the dog runs the shoreline when the swans start dumping into the tidal marshes. And all the dog does is go back and forth on the shoreline. And the swans come in closer to see what the dog is doing. And these birds were a country mile away from us. And it took about an hour and a half. But before you knew it, they were 30 yards offshore looking at the dog. So trying to figure out what the dog was doing. So that was one of those very unique regional hunting tactics I never thought would have worked. Had you told me that story and I'd never witnessed it, I would have called you a liar. So it was super cool because about 10 years later, Ducks Unlimited actually, they wrote an article about that sort of hunting tactic in the Carolinas. And I just thought that was cooler than hell.
Yeah, that's like me and like after we shot that coyote, that boy was like, you know, you left your dog like 800 yards away. And I was like, ah, she'll be fine. Being that I then like kind of realized that all the hounds had ran towards her, but like that was like, he was like, man, I was like, have you ever seen like a coyote? Cause he coyote hunts. And he's like, no, I've never seen dogs bay a coyote. I've seen coyotes chase dogs, but it's normally a pack one or a pack one, two or three. But like, that's a crazy flip on like out west. You have the guys who do the big dogs and the little dog tactics, or they do the big dog tactics and stuff. And
I've been on a couple, so I don't know a ton about it to, you know, say, oh, you should do this or do that. But I got a good buddy named Steve Bosselman, who is, he's well known in that coyote world. And when he talks, people listen. So, he runs around in northwestern Ohio, up around Toledo, Maumee area. So, and yeah. He's had some pretty heavy hitters coming in his area. Just spend some time with him, do some training, see what he does with his dogs, how he runs them, commands, what he watches for. The technology right now is just amazing on him. Another buddy of mine went on a Carolina bear hunt, and they're using the same technology down there where they use GPS tracking to track the dogs. And just based off of what you're seeing on that little screen, they can tell when they have something baited up, whether it's a dog or a coyote. And then that's when they'll go ahead and start making their moves towards it. So the game's really changed for him. But yeah, Steve is a good dude. Yeah, he's one of the few guys I know it seems like the coyote guys chase a lot of the black dogs. They really like the black coyotes. I know for sure he's got two to his credit. He's also got one with a diamond patch on it as well, too. So yeah, he's got quite a few trophies just sitting in his man cave. So, and he's very good at it. So, and just a hell of a good dude. Just a hell of a good dude and a hell of a waterfowl hunter.
Yeah, and that's something that's kind of crazy. Like, a lot of coyote guys actually are waterfowl hunters, which is great because that's something that, like, I kind of want to pick up. Not necessarily killing coyotes, but, like, we've talked about, me and some of my buddies, that, like, you know, there's no more fur trade. There's no more really selling of furs. So you've got some people that are still trapping coons and beavers and stuff and coyotes and stuff, but there's not as many that once was doing it. I mean, there's articles. You can go out and find articles where the Dakotas never had coons. And then the trapping all stopped and all the stuff, and then now they're swarmed in coons because they're just cornland.
Yeah.
I mean,
I would agree.
That's a crazy thing.
I would agree with you.
I mean, I personally don't really go out and do any type of coon, coyote, or anything like that. And that's something that, like, I've actually wanted to kind of do better. So I'm actually kind of – that's what I was more excited about, killing the coyote, just because I was like, you know, that's one thing I've killed towards, you know, maybe saving a baby goose or saving a baby duck for some reason. That coyote might, like, wander across one.
Yeah, you know, coyotes and coons, I think coons are rough around the geese and the ducks.
Yeah, I say coons are probably the worst.
Great point, man. Yeah, coons are becoming a serious problem, especially up in the duck factory, we'll call it. So I remember my last trip 3 years ago up there. That was problematic, and actually the landowner that gave us permission to hunt his field asked if we'd take care of the coons, and a couple of his grandsons came down. So, but I've never seen a coon infestation this bad. And it was basically just in an old hay barn. So, but when we got to rocking that thing and started running through that thing, broad daylight, I'm not kidding. I'll bet you we spooked 60 coons out of that thing. And you just want to talk about a turkey shoot. Holy cow. There was dead coons all over the place. So, and that's one small spot up in White Church, North Dakota.
Yeah, that's something that, like, I've kind of wanting to move towards and do more is some coon calling and coon hunting. I just impulse bought one of them Lucky Duck calls because I've seen guys use them. I know they got the coon calls built already into the call and stuff, and it has the coyote and everything already in it. So I actually went ahead and bought one, and that's kind of my goal. I actually want to do a little bit of coon calling. I think it'd be a fun. It'd be something great to get a kid out on because you don't have to do it early. You're not doing it at night. You're doing it like 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock in the day while they're asleep, and you're just trying to pick a fight is what you're really trying to do.
Yeah.
I think it would be very similar to something like a turkey hunt, but very fast-paced and just something where I feel like it won't be, you know, as, you know, like you can't like move as much. You don't have to worry about like being as still. I feel like they're going to be very easily tricked. I may be completely wrong and they may outsmart me all day long like the geese do, but I don't know.
I don't know. I know, Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, parts of Indiana, it's kind of a hotbed for coon dogs. There's a lot of great coon hunters in this particular area. I know Ohio's got, I think in the last like 12 years, I knew one guy won 3 world championships. There was another guy that was kind of a protege to him or kind of a mentee, so to speak. I know he went out and won a couple world titles too. So it's kind of a hotbed just in this particular area as far as, you know, running coon dogs and, you know, treating them. So there's a lot of guys in this area that you could probably talk to just kind of give you some advice on how to do it. And I think it's a great idea getting a young person involved in it too, being a mentor to them.
Yeah, the one thing about coon hunters, and this is nothing bad about them, but if you're talking about competition coon hunters, the way their scoring system and everything works, unless it's a poundage hunt, which is not that common because they hunt pretty much year-round, but they train and run and compete year-round because, you know, my dad was in it big when I was growing up and stuff. They love places that are full coon. So those are kind of the guys who, like, they're like, yeah, you know, if you could just leave them all in there, that'd be awesome. You know, I can – they run a hunt, and they can bring a group of 4 guys there and, you know – their dog kind of used to that area. They can really slam some points up quick. I know my dad, he was a guide one night for for the West Virginia State hunt. And I think they treed, I want to say 8 coons in one night, 8 to 10 coons in one night, split treed like 3 times. And I mean, the scorecard was just lit in half on and those guys were like, they were looking at my dad like, oh my gosh. Granted, there's no waterfowl in that area where they were, but if you're looking at other states other than West Virginia, there's usually waterfowl fairly close to the coons. I mean, we've got a lot of hollers and mountains and stuff where most of the coon hunting happens. We don't hunt as much on our rivers and our bottoms.
I look at it like this. Predators go where there's food. That's it. They're on the go. So where they have a sustainable food source, that's where they're going to be. So whether it be pheasant, whether it be quail, whether it be dove, partridge, or waterfowl, that's where they're going to be.
Yeah. And so, and something that like you have to think about when I said that is, I don't know the regulations on all these other states, but I know in West Virginia, if we go and pull someone's trail camera on their feeder, we can probably find 15, 20 coons on it. And that's like they feed those things. And I mean, those guys really don't realize that they've drawn all those coons in there. Those coons would normally not be able to survive in that tight of an area and that many coons if it wasn't for that feeder. And it's kind of the reason why we're having more bears travel through our areas and stuff than what we normally do, because they're hitting these deer feeders and stuff and kind of being able to live off of a deer feeder and not really have to worry about much.
Yeah, that and pretty much, you know, just all the growth we have between your state, our state, some of the other states, a lot of these Midwestern states are just blowing up. So, and it's just, you got to look at food sources from a different perspective. So, I mean, there was an article probably about 2 years ago in the Columbus Dispatch where they were talking about abandoned houses on these reclaimed blocks where developments were going to go in. And they're finding entire packs of coyotes living in abandoned houses.
Oh, yeah.
Urban coyotes. So they were finding urban raccoons. So animals adapt. That's what, you know, we're Midwestern, you know, we assume that stuff's going to be more rural. So if you go over to Alaska, I mean, it's nothing to deal with. There's polar bear sightings at the dump. There's polar bear sightings downtown. So they'll go across your CB radios and let everyone know, hey, we've sighted 3 polar bears downtown. Just be careful when you guys go out. So it's pretty common for them up in those rural areas because predators are going to go to where the food's at. So we might look as trash. Bears and raccoons and coyotes are looking at as, you know, man, I got a Thanksgiving dinner here.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and look at the tourist attractions when you, as far as like Yellowstone and all that, like all the bear attacks that happen in Yellowstone, and then you go to California and look at all the mountain lion attacks and stuff. And those attacks are not that far into nature. I don't think people understand that.
Did you see the coyote attack on the toddler?
Yeah, that was in like a middle of a subdivision.
That middle of subdivision, middle of the day, and it was just the dad's. They went to the grocery store, and dad, you know, he jumps out of the vehicle, opens up the back door, pulls, you know, the baby out of the, you know, the car seat, and the baby sees mom, you know, is going to run up to go see mom. He walks around the other side of the car, and him and the coyote pass each other. So, and next thing you know, you hear the kid screaming and you hear mom screaming, and he's like, he's dumbfounded. Like, what's going on? And he walks around the car and there's a coyote dragging his kid down the street. Broad daylight.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. I mean, look at the bobcats attacks. You have those. And, I mean, those are getting to be a little more common than what they ever used to be. I mean, there is no fur trade. There's no – I think I heard Jeff Nimitz, which is a guy that is a big-time coyote hunter. He has a Lucky Duck show called The Last Stand. He was talking about how, like, I think it was over 50% – of furs that were sent to Canada to sell did not sell last year. So that means this year there's going to be less of an incentive for all those guys that sent those furs there to do it again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
No, I don't even think Canada... I know at one point when we were in Canada, they had a bounty on coyotes. So it was $50 a coyote.
But what year was that? I'm not trying to age you.
Oh, Jesus. No, you're fine. God, it was 2006, 2008, 2010. So, and then the next time we went up, they said they got rid of the bounty because there was guys coming out of Alberta into Saskatchewan, and they were collecting on the bounty. So, and the bounty was just for Saskatchewan. So, but the coyote population, it just absolutely blew up. So, but they had a lot of people scamming it. And the pronghorn numbers were down because of it.
Well, here's a fun one to look at due to waterfowl. This is proven a waterfowl fact. I think it's for the first, it was either for the first time last year or the year before that they recorded that all 3 bear species, there was more than 3 bear species, but brown bears, polar bears and black bears were all found in the tundra chasing the waterfowl. Like they're, you know what I mean? They're nesting grounds because there's so much food there. They've learned they can all go there. And those are 3 bears you don't find together anywhere else other than there.
No.
I mean, you don't find black bears and brown bears together in any of the states. Like, I mean, if you have one, you don't have the other.
I watched a National Geographic. It was saying the same thing with the wolves. There was wolf packs that were actually hammering on the snow geese.
Yeah, I mean.
So, I mean, it's a food source. We know weather patterns are changing. So, I'm a guy that likes to keep, I don't want to say a diary, but I keep a log of every hunting season. So when I go on a trip, you know, where I'm going, what's the weather, what's the barometric pressure. So what are we chasing? How many guys do they go out with? So it takes 5 minutes to do, but it's amazing. Just I have a library of these books. So and my buddies come over to the house, and sometimes they'll pull them and look at them. It's just like, man, that was a dandy, or man, you got skunked on this day. And I'm like, yeah, it's that barometric pressure that kind of killed us on that day. But I think what I'm getting at here is just we know weather patterns are changing, and the predators are adapting in order to accommodate, you know, to put food in their bellies. So there were some great studies done about polar bears. We hear all these stories about polar bears swimming for, you know, 2 days trying to find food because the Arctic Circle is no longer freezing up so they can chase seals. Well, a lot of them have switched over to making walrus their main food source as opposed to seal. And they're getting very creative about how they chase after walruses. So, and in areas that are dominant with walrus, they're finding actually overweight polar bears and some amazingly sized polar bears because they've changed that. You know, that used to be once in a while they would handle a walrus. And now that's the mainstay of their diet.
Yeah, that's
so it doesn't surprise me when we're hearing that there's more predators moving into the tundra to start hammering out waterfowl, especially during the molt or the nesting season. It's a food source.
Yeah, which then if you look at it, I mean, and the bird that they're going after is the snows and the specks. They're probably picking up ducks and Canadians and stuff like that, but the birds they're mainly going there for are the snows and the specks, which, you know, so good little quick little segue here. You know, we're talking about predators and stuff, and predators tend to get mange, and that's a way to weed them out. Now we have this avian flu that's hit waterfowl this year, and it's kind of, they've seen it pretty much across everything, every species, but it's mainly going to hit the snows and the specks, they've said, because of how they congregate together and stuff, which I find crazy that, you know, it came to nature having to take a course to take care of those when, they basically opened up the doors to kill these things. And I mean, they're that hard to kill and they can multiply that fast still. With the predators.
Yeah, I mean, Mother Nature throws all they have at them and they continue to thrive. It's avian bird flu. First of all, let me tell you, avian bird flu screwed our Canada trip this year because we were slated to go. And then it came out that Justin Trudeau had shut down American hunters taking waterfowl back. So, and I know there were some guys that still went. I wasn't going to go. We eat what we kill. So, it was one of those deals where, you know, we was bringing home 3 days worth of birds. So, and I didn't want to be a situation where we got into a dandy snow goose hunt like we usually get into up there. And then all of a sudden not knowing what to do with the birds. So there's only so many you can donate. And then you find yourself in sticky situations. So that was just a bad deal. So we unfortunately had to cancel our trip. We do plan on going next year. Ironic twist, about a week before our trip was planned, the border was opened up so Americans can bring back waterfowl. So that was mildly frustrating because we'd already canceled and kind of set up for going next year. But as far as the avian flu goes, I've heard of three massive sites they found in North Dakota. It was two in North Dakota, one in South Dakota. So where they actually found hundreds of dead snow geese due to avian flu.
Yeah.
And so one, they actually thought it was a drop. It was just someone dumping birds. So, and then they started doing their testing and looking at birds and realized that's not the case. This is something different. Ended up being avian bird flu on all those birds.
Yeah. And I am concerned about it, but like, I think we also have to look at like, I'm concerned about the numbers that it will affect, but I'm a little more concerned about how it could affect the poultry business again, being that I do farm a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't farm in chickens and stuff. I don't want to ever farm in chickens, but I know people who do farm in chickens and stuff. And we've had that happen before. We had, just in West Virginia, which is a big time chicken producer. We had, a fire at one of our farms just a couple nights ago, and that's already going to kind of hurt the numbers, but I mean, that's something that I don't think people do realize that can hit and can be a bigger factor. And the last time it hit, I think we talked about it, had like a 2 year, took about 2 years before it to make its run through. So, I mean, we're just on the
front. Yeah, there's a big process that goes through. I mean, you're redoing pretty much all feed lines, all water lines. You got to turn the dirt. From what I understand, there's actually a special product you got to sprinkle all over the dirt, and you got to work that in constantly. I don't want to call it a fertilizer, but it's something that will actually kill the pathogen.
Yeah, it's like I wouldn't call it a lime, but something similar to a lime.
I'll tell you what, I'll dig into this. I actually have, I have two pieces of property where they actually raise chickens. So my one farmer still does free range on his one property. The other one has actually gone to penned in. So, and he's actually put, you know, he's actually put tops on all his pens. Originally, he just kind of had it as, and he was wide open. So, but he had like 15 or 20 different access points just in case birds of prey came by. But just to make sure the waterfowl weren't getting into his pens for free food and free drink, he went ahead and put tops on everything. So he shared stories with me where he literally had ducks landing on top of his pens. So I know it is a concern for anyone that does work with poultry. I think for hunters, probably the biggest thing, wash your hands before you stick anything in your mouth.
Yeah.
That's the absolute truth. Your skin is a natural barrier to prevent any pathogens from getting in. So as long as you wash your hands, even if you handle the bird with avian bird flu, you're not going to pass that pathogen into yourself.
Yeah. So, I know it's a concern with dogs and stuff also people have talked about. And
yeah.
For me, the way I'm approaching that with my two dogs are I'm kind of watching the birds and trying, I'm not going to let my dogs lick on a bird after they've retrieved it. I'm kind of going to make sure they kind of, you know what I mean? Like if it's a bloodied up, busted up bird, yeah, I'll pick that one up myself. Let's not let them put a bloodied up bird in their mouth. Cause it's, saliva, your mouth is a mucous membrane access, your nose and all that, which same thing with a dog, and it just gets it right in. It's a pathogen, basically. It's a natural pathogen, but, you know, your skin, like you said, as long as you're washing it, I bring your dog home, wash them, wipe them down when you put them in the truck. You know, don't really, if you notice them licking on themselves, maybe check to see why they're licking. Just kind of be smart, you know. Maybe take a second and don't like shoot it the next flock of geese. Maybe check your dog and just make sure, you know, everything's up and up.
I would agree. Man, it's the only thing you really can do to combat it right now. So the last thing we need is another vaccination. So, but I think exercising a little caution, protect the family pet, you know, protect the dog. And it protects yourselves as well too. So the biggest thing we do, just honestly, you know, just wash hands. So, you know, I use, I carry, if you look at my truck door, I have baby wipes for getting face paint off it, and I have alcohol wipes. So, which you do not ever, ever want to mix those two up, because I've accidentally done that before, and that was horrible. It was a miserable experience. My friends laugh at it, but yeah, it scarred me for life.
Yeah, I'd say so. So before we, as we get ready to wrap this podcast up, you know, the first one back, I wanted to do a little quick talk about, you know, where did Red Lake Talk, you know, I'm just the producer. I'm just the guy with the board pushing the buttons and making stuff happen, doing the music and doing all that fun stuff. You're kind of the host of this thing. And, you know, I wanted it to be Red Lake Talk because that, you know, ever since I've met you and known you, it's always been Red Leg. It's always been either the username or anything to that. So, you know, we know what Red Leg comes from. It comes from mallard ducks, but, you know, can you dive in a little more into it?
I think for me, it's just that it's probably about 15 years ago, and I ended up doing an interview with R.D. Smith, and he interviewed about half a dozen of us. You know, it was, what's your favorite waterfall to pursue? And for me, it's always been a mallard. For me, the mallard's king. You know, almost 95% of the duck calls that are sold in America are mallard calls. So you find them in coastal waters, you find them in the oceans, you find them in tidal marshes, you find them in swamps, cornfields, you name it. You know, they're just all over the place. They're the most abundant duck we have. And there's something about how they work, how cautious they become, how they get wary, how when they just do it right, there's something magical about it. You know, the way they'll come into cornfields or rice fields or the flooded timber, you know, 20 minutes before shooting time, and, you know, watching how they'll work up in Canada. You know, and you explain it to people, and they're just like, yeah, whatever, you had 5,000 ducks land into you. And then guys in Canada are like, oh, yeah, yeah, you find peas? It's nothing at 5,000 ducks land, and they're all mallards. So for me, that's just, it's the king of the duck. And I know there's other guys out there that they prefer chasing canvasbacks, or they prefer those eiders or harlequins, or, you know, they've got that favorite duck they love to chase. It's just, for me, it's always been the mallard. And it has a lot to do with our company. So, you know, we consider ourselves, we make the best damn duck and goose calls on the market. So it's how I pay my bills. It's how I feed my family. So it's how I bring a great group of guys together. So it's just chasing them ducks. So, so Red Leg is just, you know, there's 50 nicknames, but man, I love it the way the guys down south call them, you know, them Red Legs. So I love it when the Red Legs up, man. And them drakes are real easy to work, hitting with a couple lone hens, you know, really dragging it out, getting real raspy and nasty on it, and watching them break their necks and get into your decoy spread to find her. So, I guess you'd call it romantic, nostalgic, if you will. So, it's the first duck I ever shot in my life, and I hope to God it's the last duck. You know, when I'm 90 years old and can barely lift a gun, I hope that's the last bird I take. So, but there's just a lot of good memories with it. So, and there's nothing better. You know, I love eating them too, especially late January birds that are corn-fed. Man, a little buttermilk, and man, you can deep-fry them things. You can saute them. You can roast them. So there's 50 different ways to prepare them. So, by the way, take a note on that buttermilk. It works great. So for those of you guys that don't know, I'm actually an executive chef. So, and I actually teach culinary arts at a high school and two different colleges. So, you know, we do a big, big chunk on how to prepare wild game. So, and buttermilk solves a lot of problems. It really does.
Yeah, man, it's actually a technique that I'm using more often in my cooking with duck and geese. I find duck and geese to be very, very good. It's something that, like, a lot of people are like, you eat those things? I'm like, yeah. I think that there's like a lot of, and the same thing with deer. I like, when I kill a deer, I don't just send it off to make summer sausage. I mean, there's a huge business in the people that just dump them off to have summer sausage made. I like to butcher my own. If I do summer sausage, maybe I'll cut some up and like put it to the side and I'll send that off to be done in the summer sausage, or I'll do it myself. But I like the butchering of the animal and trying to use as much of it as I can. My good buddy Clark, he's very good at, you know, he pulls legs, everything off. I mean, he is as detailed as they can get, and he's pretty awesome to kind of watch work up a bird, because he does a very good job, you know, not wasting a thing.
Well, yeah, he's probably a surgeon. No. So I'll tell you, I use that as a term of endearment. You know, he's just that good working a knife that he's going to get every ounce of meat off of it. He knows what cuts are the good ones. Honestly, one that gets overlooked all the time, it's on all poultry, it's called the oysters. So, and it's a super, super tender piece of meat. And what you do is you'll actually take the bird and you're going to put your hands in between the thighs, grasp the thighs and the legs in one hand. And basically you just kind of pull them back and look at the back of the bird. you're going to see two bumps appear in the small of the back above the tail. Those are called the oysters, and they sit right on the hip bone. So if you actually dislocate those, you can pull the oysters out. And on a goose, they're about an ounce. It's a good portion, and it is absolutely tender. So it's the one part of the bird that can be tender. So, but another trick with goose, and I share this with guys all the time, and they're looking at me like, are you kidding me? So we always have it where we have to chase a goose, and the problem is you get adrenaline going in the goose. And what it does is it stiffens up the meat. So, and even after 2 or 3 days of sitting in the brine, the meat is still super tough. So the brine can't pull the adrenaline out of it. Well, something you can do is you can use non-flavored everyday yogurt. So put that in a steel bowl, cover the meat, let it sit for about 4 or 5 hours, and that meat will be so tender you could push your thumb and your forefinger right through it. So, and it makes a world of difference. And you can use that on any sort of red protein. So, but yeah, a lot of guys don't look at those oysters. Go after those oysters. Oysters are absolutely delicious. I love just sauteing mine. Once I pull them out of brine, I like a little red wine vinegar because it gives it a natural heat to it. But yeah, a little bit of garlic, a little thyme, salt and pepper. Real simple, real easy with some roasted potatoes and asparagus. It's an absolutely fantastic meal.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, we're going to wrap this up right here because we're like 40-ish minutes in. And so moving forward with this podcast, the goal was going to be we're going to talk a lot of just like we just did, like life stuff, and really communicate about, you know, real life things, whether it be like in the hunting industry or what's just going on in life. But we're also going to come back and we're going to talk cooking recipes. We're going to talk about different goose calls and duck calls, calling techniques, and different things. I'm learning to blow a spec call, so we're going to talk a little bit about that down the road somewhere when I get a little better. And we're going to break down different things because, I mean, you're a very veteran hunter, very veteran caller, and I'm kind of, I would say, a novice still. I don't think I'm at that amateur level. I can get myself in the right spot. It's just working the call sometimes. Actually, it just depends on what you give me as a weapon. Sometimes I can make it happen. Sometimes I can't. You know, sometimes you drop your call in the water and it sinks to the bottom and now you don't have a goose call and you're pulling the bee squad out of the bag. But we're going to talk about, you know, just fun stuff as we move forward for this, and it's going to be a great time. The goal is to come back every other week with a new episode, and I'm pretty excited to sit down and talk to you every week, every other week.
Yeah, we're going to have 2 weeks of duck season in. We've got this weekend already kind of figured out, so we're hoping we can beat the tar out of them. And, I'll probably take some pictures and share some recipes. And, we can kind of talk about some techniques as far as calling, working birds, you know, decoy setups, little things that kind of separate a good hunt from a great hunt.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one thing that everyone has their own style and their own method of doing something. And you do stuff one way, I do stuff another way down here. And we've got friends that are from all over that do stuff different ways there. And it's pretty awesome to be able to kind of talk about different decoys, different calls, different this, different that, and just work our way through, you know, hit a bourbon every once in a while, hit a recipe every once in a while, just have a good time and sit back and enjoy every night.
No, I agree, man. And you and I have got quite a few hunts in together, and it's been nothing but a blast. So, you know, I don't point out last year that I said, hey, Nate, jump in my blind so I can film, as you were doing all the heavy lifting, and we won't talk about you whipping.
No. So. and it comes down to, and that was, I mean, that was fully on me. And I mean, I have a hard time switching, and I'm very bad about it. And we can talk about it sometime, but I'm very bad at switching from filming mindset to a hunting mindset, that sometimes it's good when I'm going from the filming mindset to the hunting mindset for me, because I at least know my filming mindset was there, but it's rougher on me when I'm going from a hunting mindset to a filming mindset. And like, I'm still so like drawn into the hunt that like, I can't process what's going on with the camera and everything in my mind, which
if anyone ever questioned your dedication to what you do, I would probably shock them right in the eye. And that's the truth, man. I love you. You're a good dude. And I wish I had just a tenth of the talent you have for just the techie stuff. So, it's for me, it's just always a blast going out and just hunting with guys. I know we got to hunt with Ward last year as well, too. But with, you know, Seth and Sean, John, Justin, those guys, that's always a great time, especially when you get Andy going and Nick. Oh, so, wow. And I'm a blessed individual to be part of that group. I get to hang out with you guys and just shoot a pile of birds and just crack jokes. So every now and then when you see guys whiff, and you weren't the only one that whiffed. So you did make a good recovery. So
no, but yeah, but man, it's been an awesome time, and we're gonna catch all you guys in 2 weeks, and can't wait to hear from you guys in a few weeks.
Absolutely, let's tear them up. Be safe, guys.
Yep. Remember, we're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Make sure you subscribe and check us out.